Ted Wong invited Alain Bernard, myself, and three other people to visit China. It was a visit that was an invitation that was extended actually by the All China Federation of Trade Unions, the FTU. I'm still learning it. We spent 10 days in China. We went to Beijing, Dalian, and Shanghai. We visited a number of plants, and we met with many, many officials of the union. This past September, Kent took another delegation to China. These were real heavyweights. These were Andy Stern from SEIU, Paul Booth from ASME, and Tom Rankin from the California State Federation. A number of articles came out about these trips, both in the Hong Kong press and the U.S. press, and I just want to give you a little bit of a flavor of what came out. The New York Sun had a front page banner headline, "Labor Unions in a Rift Over Communist China." And it went on to say that the trip signals tensions within the American labor movement between the veteran anti-communists of the Lane Kirkland era and the vanguard of younger veterans of the 1960s era social change movements who came to the fore of the labor movement along with the AFL-CIO's president, John Sweeney. It's a rather interesting formulation. Only were true. The article went on to quote Kent and Elaine's piece in our earlier journal. If you haven't seen that, there was an earlier article that Kent and Elaine wrote about this issue. So we have that too available. It was a debate actually with Mark Levinson and Thea Lee. So if you're interested in this issue, have us dig up that old copy of New Labor Forum. It's available. Business Week then went on to report that the AFL-CIO was, quote, red-faced about the trip, and that it was, quote, backpedaling hard to distance itself from the trips. And then finally, the Boston Herald made references to Andy Stern's communist field trip and called it all very, very bizarre. So, that's where we're at. What were these trips really about? And more importantly, what is China really about? What has the transition to a market economy meant for the Chinese workers? What is, in fact, the role of the ACFTU in China? And how should the U.S. labor movement relate to the Chinese Federation? The answers to those questions aren't easy, or at least I think they're a lot tougher than they first appear. And trying to answer them, I think, raises some very sobering issues for the left and for the progressive movement. I tried to grapple with some of those in my article in the journal. But today we have Kent and Elaine here who will help us sort of work through some of that stuff. Elaine is the executive director, and I want to get this right because it's a new title, Harvard University's Labor and Work-Life Program, more commonly known as the Trade Union Program at Harvard. She's the former head of British Columbia's New Democratic Party. She's got a PhD in history, and I think most of you know her reputation as a scholar and as a speaker. Kent Wong is the director of the Center for Labor Research at UCLA. He is the one of the founders and former presidents of APALA, the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance, and he served as a staff attorney for SEIU. He has a juris degree, and we could go on and on about these two people, but more important. I think it's important to get to hear them. Please join me in welcoming Kent Long and Elaine Bernard.
Thanks very much, Greg. Thank you for the invitation, and it's great to be here in New York. I wanted to kind of break this presentation into two parts. I was going to focus my remarks much more on kind of the history and background of this issue within the AFL-CIO and how the American labor movement has historically addressed the issue of China. And then I was going to call on my good friend Elaine to talk more about our recent trip this past spring to China, where we met with the unions of China, the ACFTU, and more about some of the changes going on in China today and why that also motivates us to rethink and to evaluate and to really take stock in what the AFL-CIO position historically has been and where we think it should go. This kind of this story begins during the process of building the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance. I first met with then AFL-CIO President Lane Kirkland back in the early 90s to first talk about the necessity of establishing a national Asian American labor organization. And I first met Lane Kirkland at a meeting of the National Endowment for Democracy. This was a very bizarre meeting. It was right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the people in the room were just ecstatic because they were convinced that the NED was responsible for the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. And then, of course, they were all shifting their attention to the remaining, the remnants of the evil empire, and China was right there, you know, front and center. What was also very disheartening from my perspective in watching this meeting between Lane Kirkland and Orrin Hatch and Zubrinsky and the Chamber of Commerce and the Democratic Party and the Republican Party was how far right the AFL-CIO was on issues internationally. That consistently they were to the right of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce when it came to international issues. And whereas the U.S. Chamber of Commerce were very committed to promote the interests of U.S. capital around the world, the AFL-CIO was much more ideologically driven to fight communism. I mean, that was their reason for engaging in the international arena on many different fronts. And so this was kind of like a scary first introduction to Lane Kirkland. And then when I sat out and met with them, I tried to distance myself as much as possible because I didn't want to talk about China at all. But of course, it came up in the conversation when I was talking about the necessity of building the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance. And he said to me, you know, I had some Chinese dissidents in my office the other day. And I kind of said, well, that's interesting. I was thinking to myself, well, actually, we're Asian American dissidents. You know, I don't think we would have gotten the. And I remember having the first meeting of Asian American labor activists throughout the country when we first went to the National AFL-CIO headquarters. Most of us had never been there before. You know, most of us, you know, even though I had been in the labor movement then for, you know, my entire adult life, it was something that was still quite a foreign territory to us. And I remember people coming out of the hallways when they saw a group of Asian American labor activists walking through the halls and sticking their heads out and saying, well, what country are they from? Because no one in the AFL-CIO had ever seen a delegation of Asian American labor activists before, and they assumed they'd seen lots of, you know, folks, foreign delegates, so they assumed that we were from another country. And I remember even the night before the founding Apollo Convention, it was on May 1st, 1992, not a coincidence in terms of our selection of the date, but the evening before our national convention, I was being hammered by the International Affairs Department that they demanded that Apollo take a position against China. And I was going, look, this is not our issue. This is not something that we think that we should engage around. We are a group of Asian American workers. We are very much committed to organizing and empowering Asian workers in this country, but in the, you know, view of the International Affairs Department, here they were launching this major boycott of Chinese toys. Here they were involved in all of these campaigns against China, and they thought that because we were going to be an organization of the AFL-CIO, that should be our position as well. And And anyway, so I basically deflected that and said, no, that's not what we're about. We're about organizing Asian American workers, recruiting and training new Asian American activists. What I didn't let on at that point is that the vast majority of our membership completely disagreed with the AFL-CIO position, but tactically that wasn't our interest in engaging at that point when we were just trying to get our organization up and running. So APALA has been around now for 10 years. We've done some great work in recruiting and training Asian American organizers coast to coast, supporting a whole new series of campaigns that are targeting Asian American workers in California and other parts of the country. And more recently, we've also really seen a need to revisit this issue of China and to really advocate for a change in policy of the AFL-CIO. We were quite excited with the election of John Sweeney and the new leadership back in 1995. We've been quite excited about seeing some of the huge changes in the international affairs arena of the AFL-CIO, particularly on Latin America. You know, as there's been major changes in AFL-CIO foreign policy. The AFL-CIO used to support, you know, the Contras in Central America, used to support U.S. aggression in Vietnam, used to support a whole series of very, you know, right-wing positions. And in recent years, we've seen a major shift and a major turnaround on a number of their positions. You know, in Brazil, they set up a white union to oppose coups and to oppose Lula. And now the Solidarity Center there is almost working exclusively with the coup and with the progressive unionists of Brazil. So there's been a lot of very positive change in different parts of the world. But unfortunately, on China, there has been no change. And even when the International Women's meeting was held, the UN meeting was held in Beijing, the AFL-CIO forbid any of their members to attend because it was held in China. This came to a head in, you know, 2000 when the AFL-CIO spearheaded a massive coast-to-coast campaign to try to deny permanent normal trade status with China and try to oppose China's entry into the World Trade Organization. And for many of us in APALA, we found this just appalling. That here, after the anti-WTO demonstration in Seattle in the end of 1999, where the U.S. labor movement projected a new vision to the world that they were standing in solidarity with environmental and human rights and women's rights activists in Seattle, and were speaking out against policies of corporate domination and globalization. The very next thing that they're rolling out as their the centerpiece of their international policy is this campaign against China. And during this campaign, if you look at the AFL-CIO rhetoric that came out, where John Sweeney saying that China needs to join the civilized world, where George Becker, the president of the Steelworkers Union at that time, getting on stage, you know, denouncing China as a godless society, where Pat Buchanan was invited by the president of the Teamsters, Jimmy Hoffa, and makes these racist jokes in front of these rallies in D.C., talking about, you know, no tiki, no laundry for China. And where Gary Bauer and Rich Trumpgar on national TV, in total agreement, in total alignment on their position on China. This was a huge step backward in our perspective with regard to the AFL-CIO position in the international arena, found the worst forces of anti-communism and racism in the society, and really undermined the AFL-CIO's credibility within the progressive community in this country and throughout the world. So that's really what prompted Elaine and I to write an article in the New Labor Forum, which helped open up this debate on whether this is really the good policy of the AFL-CIO to hold on to this anti-China position, and to explore, well, isn't it really about time for for the American labor movement to reach out to unions and workers in China and to provoke a new perspective with regard to international solidarity. And so at the 2001 Apollo Convention, for the very first time, we invited representatives of the Chinese labor movement to attend the our convention. And this was a big deal because they had never been invited by the American labor movement to come to a national labor convention in this country. And so I remember having a whole series of meetings with them. They were fascinated about, you know, why is it that you folks are inviting us, and who are you anyway, and what's your relationship with the AFL-CIO, and why is it that the AFL-CIO refuses to meet with us, and why are they the most, you know, virulent anti-China force, much further to the right than, once again, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Republican Party, or anyone else in the political spectrum, you know, probably right up there with the Christian right in relation to their position on China. And so we had a series of conversations at the Apollo Convention back in 2001, and at that time they invited me to organize a delegation to China. So I invited my two good friends, Greg Mancios and Elaine Bernard, from the labor education world, because we thought that it was very important to engage labor educators, labor academics, to generate some discussion within our community on this issue. And then I also invited some of the key Apollo leaders, both from the Service Employees International Union, Rocky Reddy, and the HERE, Susan Minato, because I knew that those two unions in particular were much more open to a more progressive position on China. That was our trip in March, and then in September, I brought back a second delegation just a few months ago, and that included Andy Stern from SEIU, Paul Booth from AFSCME, Tom Rankin, who is the president of the California Labor Federation, and Louisa Blue, who's the current president of the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance. And we met with the chair of the All China Federation of Trade Unions, Wei Jinxiang. We met with leaders of trade unions in Beijing and Shanghai. We visited unions at a hospital, at a school, and also at the Shanghai GM plant. So it was very interesting meeting the union leaders and union members at the Shanghai GM plant. He said, you know, we have relations with the German trade unions and the French trade unions and the British trade unions and the Japanese trade unions. And all these other auto worker unions come to us, but for some reason we have no relationship with the UAW, even though we're working for Shanghai GM. You know, what's up with that? And it wasn't an easy question for us to respond to, like, what is the interest of U.S. labor movement to refuse to have any contact, dialogue, communication, exchange whatsoever with unions in China. So this particular delegation, because of who went, it was the first time in over 20 years that a U.S. Union president had visited China, caused quite a bit of controversy and drew considerable attention, both in China. We were the national news in China, and made the press in Hong Kong, made Pravda, made, you know, a lot of the press in this country, and was has helped to kind of open up this debate and this discussion. You know, what should we have any relationships with unions in China, and what should the proper perspective on this issue be? What was very clear to us in, you know, both the trips in the spring and in the fall was that the Chinese country, the Chinese economy, the Chinese society is undergoing incredible change and transformation. That it is a very dynamic and vibrant economy, that it is increasingly playing a larger and larger role in the international economy. That in terms of U.S. and China relations, that virtually every other segment of our society has relations with China. You have all these academic exchanges, university to university, you know, all of these business exchanges. U.S. capital is not missing a beat in terms of massive investments in China. You have government-to-government exchange. In the post-9/11, you even have CIA to, you know, intelligence exchange. So there's all of this. There's student, cultural, you know, every other sector of society is involved in some level of change, exchange with China, except the U.S. labor movement. If you look at the international arena, the Chinese labor movement has relations with the German trade unions, with the Japanese trade unions, with the Australian trade unions, with the French, with the British, with the Scandinavian trade unions. The German trade union movement even has an office in Shanghai, and they're training trade unions in China about issues of worker councils and co-determination, because China is very interested to see how the German trade union movement has been structured, given some of the issues that they are trying to confront now with the changes in the economy. And that the AFL-CIO is really out of step with the rest of the world. They're out of step with the rest of the country. And this is really one of the last, clinging remnants of this very outdated Cold War ideology that is, really holding the American labor movement back. And we think that this is not in the interests of the U.S. labor movement, nor is it in the interests of the Chinese labor movement. And we think that although clearly there are differences in perspective and history and analysis between U.S. unions and Chinese unions, that more dialogue, more engagement, more discussion is absolutely necessary. And for the AFL-CIO to continue to keep their heads in the sand and pretend that somehow they can ignore the largest trade union movement in the world, representing over 100 million members, that I think that they're really missing the boat. So we are aggressively moving forward with this process of exchange and dialogue. It's a big issue for the AFL-CIO nationally. It's not a big issue for those of us in California. I'm a member of the Teachers Union in Los Angeles, and the United Teachers of Los Angeles has had now an exchange with the Shanghai Teachers Union for the last 4 years. So we've sent two delegations of teachers over to Shanghai. We've hosted two delegations from the Shanghai Teachers Union, and it's done on an annual basis. Tom Rankin, the president of the California Federation of Labor, accompanied me on this trip. He's been very interested in improving relations with Chinese unions. Miguel Contreras, the head of the LA County Federation of Labor, just returned from China a few weeks ago and met with leaders of the ACFTU. He's very committed to improve relations, improve dialogue. In terms of Andy Stern's commitment, he is very interested in developing a healthcare worker exchange program with healthcare unions in China, and I am working with him to implement that. And specifically, we will be looking at the HIV/AIDS crisis. There are over 1 million people in China who have HIV/AIDS, and they are quite a bit behind in relation to the outreach, education, and prevention steps that they have taken. And so Andy thought that this would be a very positive initiative as a way of bringing Chinese healthcare workers, union members, to this country to learn from their counterparts here about how healthcare workers in the U.S. have been addressing the HIV/AIDS crisis and what types of effective prevention, outreach, and education methods have been used here. And we will be hopefully sending a delegation to China as well to visit clinics and hospitals and to meet with union sisters and brothers to talk about how this, once again, is an international crisis. It's an international issue that does not know boundaries. And so, like any other challenge that we are facing in this era of globalization, in this era of increasingly integrated economies, it is of historic necessity for us to break down the walls that have kept our unions and kept our workers separated in the past, and to open up a new era of dialogue, communication, and contact with unions and workers in China.
I decided that in the three questions we were asked to answer, Kent would do the top and the bottom, and I would do the middle part, which is what does China's economic boom mean for China's workers and unions? And China, of course, is a totally different situation than anywhere else where, the economy's gone through some major changes and the labor movement stuck in, some old structures and politics and traditions has been inadequate in its ability to deal with that. That makes China, of course, unique. I can't think of anywhere else in the world that labor is faced with such a problem. But let me just go through a couple of things. First, let's get a sense of this, the China boom. Let me just give you some numbers. And these numbers aren't, government numbers. These are numbers from, this latest New Yorker, my former colleague, Jeff Sachs. the growth in the Chinese economy. Remember, when the American economy started to grow by about 3%, we went, "Wow, you know, this is great. That's rapid growth." Okay, and between 78 and 98, which is like a 20-year period, the average growth in the Chinese economy was just under 10%. It was 9.8%. I mean, this is really, really rapid growth.
Right.
Now it could start from it always started from a lower base, but, most of us wish if our pensions grew at 9.8%, we'd be in a pretty good situation. The workforce moving from, because this is a big agricultural society, moving from the countryside, moving from agriculture to industry, the workforce in 78, right across the country, 71% of it was in agriculture. By 1997, and it's now grown even further, less than 50% was in agriculture. Again, a very short period of time for this change. The gross industrial output, if you look at the state-owned enterprises, the state sector, which was like everything, in 78, it accounted for 78% of the whole productivity, the whole production of the country. By 1997, it was down to a quarter. Again, very, very fast changes. Life expectancy, which is one of the ways we would measure. You know, these other numbers are nice, but, you know, what does it mean for us? What does it mean for workers? Well, life expectancy in the 70s was 64. Today, it's 70 plus. Again, in a very short period of time, a really important human indicator has gone through change. The per capita GDP, which is one of the ways, you know, the population or the total value of goods and services produced divided by the population, in 1978 was equal to that of India. Today, it's double that of India. So, you know, even compared to other countries in Asia, just to quote, can't quote Jeff Sachs and not quote my current university president, Larry Summers, in 1992 said, it may be that when the history of the late 20th century is written in 100 years' time, the most significant event would be the revolutionary change in China. And by that, he's not talking about just the changes in 49, he's also talking about the recent changes. And by the way, there's a tendency, I don't know about you, but I know when I went to China first, I have been to other parts of Asia, I've been to Malaysia, I've been to Taiwan, I truly was not expecting to see, I knew the data. One of the problems with the data is data to data. And when you actually physically go a place and you look around and you go into back alleys and you meet with people, you tend to see things very differently than what the data. What we saw was what the data was sort of telling us, but, you know, we know that China is becoming the workshop of the world. And one of the ways you might see this is when you go to a major city. Our vision would have been to see a lot of bicycles, a lot of people, but instead what we saw was a lot of motor vehicles, we saw technology, we saw, and not just on the places we were brought. I mean, renting bicycles and getting out and bicycling at 6 in the morning, you can see the degree to which industrialization is very rapidly taking over in the country, and you can understand why this is being called the workshop of the world. Now, a lot of the discussion that Kent dealt with, which deals with the politics of what should we do and what should our relationship be with the All China Federation of Trade Unions, which is, in fact, a very, unlike the rest of the labor movement, mixed bag, complex organization that's also trying to deal with change, the way most of us try to deal with change by stopping it, resisting it, trying to figure out, you know, what's it mean for us and our institutions. A lot of the discussion in the labor movement, by focusing only on the ACFTU, ignores the issue that I think is equally as important, is what's happening to the workers. Because, you know, we can look at what's happening to the labor movement, and we like to think that what's happening to the labor movement is directly related to what's happening to the workers, but there's some very interesting things that are happening to the workers. First, and it comes down to growing inequality, growing unemployment, wages and benefits, non-payment, and poor working conditions. All of which, by the way, the ACFTU, I didn't need to, this is not something that we had to alert them to. They sort of, this is the challenge before them as a labor movement. They understand that. And figuring out what their policy within this, what sort of role they can play, was really part of the issue and much of the discussions we had. Well, as I said, they went through massive changes from the 70s right up to today and continue to. And the big aspect, the big economic aspect, is moving from a non-market economy to a market economy. Non-market was the, you know, so-called iron rice bowl, where basically the government allocated workers to jobs through a state labor bureau. It paid workers in state enterprises, where, as you saw, the vast majority of workers worked, according to a nationally determined wage schedule. Workplaces provided benefits, including health care, pension, housing, job security. That was the so-called iron rice bowl. Household registration throughout the country restricted migration from the countryside to the cities. And private industry was illegal or impossible. In some instances it was possible, in theory it wasn't illegal, but with the state enterprises controlling so much both of the labor as well as the materials by which one would start an enterprise, it was impossible even where it was legal. Now, market socialism, which is the change they made economically, basically reform gave management and greater decision-making power within firms and started to create what was called a free labor market. The creation of town and village enterprises was the beginning of it, which led to the legalization over a period of years of private enterprises, and with that, a growing labor market inside the country, which led to, 95, as I said, state enterprises and urban collectives employed 144 million people. By the year 2000, it was down to 104 million. 49% of the urban workforce was now, and a shrinking, this is the place where jobs are disappearing. And you have to appreciate, like, for instance, just in one, over a four-year period, they lost something like 26 million jobs in state enterprises, and these were not necessarily picked up by the private sector. During this period, the ACFTU and other groups lobbied for and got a couple of major labor law reforms. If you read Chinese labor law today, you'd sort of wish that we could get it to replace the National Labor Relations Act. But we all know that labor law has two aspects to it. One is what's written on paper, and the other is the ability to actually exercise the rights. And you need not just the rights, but you need a vehicle to exercise it, of which, you know, in our view, an independent labor movement is crucial in doing that. In particular, the 95 law spelled out sort of three steps in dispute resolution. Mediation, you got a problem, you mediate it. And secondly, if mediation fails to deal with it, you go to arbitration. If arbitration fails to deal with it, you go to litigation, which is a thrilling notion for those of us who have dealt with litigation. The growth of inequality, of course, because one of the things the market brings is inequality, has been really quite startling. In the 1970s, China had one of the lowest rates of inequality in the world. Today, it's mid, which is not amongst the highest, like, say, Brazil, but it's not as low as it used to be. And it's been especially growing inequality within the country, not just China versus other countries. It's within the country, between regions, between the countryside and the cities, the coastal areas, which are wealthier, versus the interior, and, of course, the state-owned enterprise versus the new private enterprise. And yet, this is, in our discussions with the Chinese labor movement, this was not something that many of the leadership was too worried about. They, in the words of Deng Xiaoping, were, you know, let some get rich first, the others will follow. And one of the reasons we felt the dialogue was so important is, you know, hello, we've worked with capitalism for a long time. You guys may know something about market socialism, but we're experts on capitalism. And let me tell you something about capitalism. It doesn't work like, well, some get rich and then it trickles down. Been there, done that, doesn't work. So being able to engage in this type of dialogue was something that they were excited about and we were excited about. And we, you know, imagine this. We argued, you know? And you know what? Some of the labor leaders agreed with us. Some of them didn't agree with us. Some of them I felt just, you know, personally, I thought, I know where you're going to be in a couple of years. And many others I thought, I know exactly where you're going to be. You're going to be one of the guys on the barricades in a few years. So it's a very, you know, when you're dealing with tens of millions of people, you naturally get a wide variety. But you know what? In every other labor movement in the world, you get a variety amongst the leadership. So the inequality issue, some were worried, some saw it as necessary, some saw it as inevitable, but, you know, we're thinking about how to do some forms of redistribution, how to, you know, have a bottom floor, maybe not an iron rice bowl, you know, remember one labor leader said to us, you know, in the past we were all equally poor, and that form of equality we're not in favor of. Growing mass unemployment, and I do mean mass, if you, one of the things we did on our tour was we visited an employment center that the ACFTU runs in Beijing. It's one of many of them, which, you know, literally thousands of workers come to. It's an employment fair to look for jobs. They were young people often. They did some, not unlike our trades, some skill training at this center. But, you know, if you think about the unemployed, again, in 95, state-owned enterprises employed, you know, 111 million workers. By 99, only 86 million. That's a 26 million decrease in less than 4 years. And laid-off workers, by the way, in China are supposed to get benefits between 20 and 30%, depending on where they were, of their wages. But, of course, part of the issue of non-payment of benefits in the state enterprises, which are laying these people off, they're not getting these benefits. In the past, they were guaranteed by the state. So if the enterprise didn't pay that, you could raise hell, and the state would intervene because the state had, you know, the state and the enterprise were one and the same. Today, increasingly, the state tries to wash its hand, and the enterprise says, well, we're bankrupt, we can't afford it. You know, of course, this has never happened in America, you know, Enron or but, and so the labor movement needs to think about and was interested, well, how do we do this? How do we assure that? Another group joining the unemployed is, in fact, remember, retirement age in China is 50. So there's been a push for even earlier retirement. So you've got, when we're talking about unemployment, the numbers are very high and it's difficult to measure because what do you, you know, somebody is given early retirement at 45, is that laid off or early retirement, you know? To them it's all the same. They all of a sudden went from earning money to not earning money and being in a very difficult position as far as getting a job. A couple other points. Wages and pension arrears, according to the ACSTU, over 14 million workers were owed back pay in 1999. That's 7% of the urban workforce was owed back pay. So you got a huge sort of regulatory problem here. State-owned enterprises are, of course, in financial distress, and for a number of reasons. They're first facing what, you know, what economists call stranded costs. What are stranded costs? Under the old iron rice bowl, the state enterprise owes for, you know, pensions, health care, you know, all of those benefits, and they were residing with the enterprise. You then go into privatization, you start these new firms which hire new, you know, young workers. It doesn't have any stranded costs, costs of the retirees. So all of a sudden this new enterprise from the very beginning, we saw this, by the way, when imports, say in the auto industry or in other industries, came in, and, you know, in the steel industry or in the auto or in electronics, where a new company started up, hired, you know, new workers, had no pensioned workforce that it was paying benefits for, and, you know, had therefore lower costs, at least for a period. And so they're facing this on a massive scale. But it's, let's be utterly honest here, it's not just stranded costs, it's corruption. In a number of areas, what they've seen is that these managers have chosen to split off profitable sections of the company, and those are the ones that are privatized first to relatives. And then you strand all of the costs with the old state enterprise, and the new profitable sections are, in fact, the new private firms that are doing remarkably well, having sort of stripped the resources of the old enterprises. And this has led to a number of the protests. And then, of course, poor working conditions, which, you know, I think quite correctly a lot of human rights groups, a lot of labor groups have raised, and in fact the workers themselves and the ACFTU talks about major health and safety problems. You know, mining deaths in China are 6 times what they are, say, in the United States. I mean, just atrocious long hours, gross violations of labor law, and of course, the result is protests. You're getting all sorts of protests. According to, and these are the official numbers, the official, the Office of the Labor Ministry, the official numbers, in 1992, there were over 8,150 disputes that reached the stage of arbitration. 8,150. Big country, that's peanuts. By 1999, 120,000. 120,000 would sort of catch your attention, I think. And these are official disputes going through the official channel, registered by the ministry, you know, led by and dealt with by the ACFTU. Unofficial disputes, which are much harder to gauge because they're unofficial, they're illegal, well, Richard Freeman and I have been tracking them since 99, and between 99 and 2001, over 75 protests, strikes, and actions of workers hit the Western media. So these are the ones that are so big and create so much noise that they actually make the Western media. And, of course, the state response of all of these, which has been very interesting, has been to seek to ameliorate rather than punish. Now, that doesn't mean that some of the leaders aren't arrested, don't go to jail. But overwhelmingly, it's been to try and ameliorate. That is, to move in to try and find the funds to quiet the workers down, which in a sense is a very optimistic thing for the development of more protest. We spent a lot of time talking with leaders of the ACFTU and asking them about this. And again, we found ambivalence. We found that, you know, some of the leaders sort of saw this as something that strengthened their hands. While officially they are not part of any of these disputes, and clearly it wasn't something that they had instigated, they saw it as the workers' protest and protest for over legitimate grievances that maybe they as a union could be the vehicle through which, you know, proper resolution could happen. Others sort of saw this as just, you know, troublemaking, undermining there. Again, not unlike a lot of other labor movements. What do you do about a wildcat? What do you do about folks who organize outside of your discipline? For the most part, we didn't see any, and certainly in my following of this, these are spontaneous. They're not, you know, sort of some incipient independent labor movement that's growing up that will eventually, you know, form something like Solidarność, etc. That's certainly not what we saw. But the disputes are, in fact, very interesting, these independent ones, because they are challenging the ACFTU to figure out what to do. Disputes used to be much clearer. They used to be the workers versus the state, where the ACFTU, as a vehicle of the state, as well as a vehicle of the workers, and let's be really clear about that, felt that it had leverage to do something about it. Today, the disputes are more against the employer and the state, where the ACFTU is trying to figure out how do we work within this environment. So I guess that's a short, you know, what's the situation for workers. As you can see, there's some major challenges that the ACFTU as an organization is a very mixed bag, in my opinion. It's probably maybe harder than some of you were expecting as far as a critique of it. But get over it. You can hear some of that critique in China, contrary to... But what does the bottom line mean? The bottom line means that China right now is in... If you want to think strategically about how we as an international labor movement can affect change in our world and the condition of masses of workers, it is absolutely important that as a labor movement, we be talking to Chinese workers, we be talking to their organizations, including the ACFTU, and that we be engaging right now, because China is in the middle of one of these major changes. It has become the workshop of the world. And to stand aside while all of our bosses and our governments are going over there and engaging the institutions is to slit our own throat as well as their throat. It's totally unacceptable. So in my view, as well as I know Ken and Greg, this is a time where it would be very valuable for us in the labor movement and those of us in the education community, et cetera, that to be engaged, critically, that they're open to criticism, and what will be very interesting is, are we open to criticism as well? Because that's how we'll start to build a real solidaristic labor movement that looks at common problems of which we need a common solution. And we can only do that through working together. Thank you.
Let's open it up to questions.
Can you take an example, say, of the GM plant that Kent referred to? Mm-hmm. What's the nature of the labor organization there, how it relates to the manager, if there is?
We visited the GM Shanghai plant, and it's a very modern facility. We toured the production line. We met with the workers. We, you know, saw their, you know, working conditions. We they have a contract. They have a bargaining committee. They have a union structure where the president of the local is elected by the members, and they have probably more say in relation to the governance of the plant than, you know, counterparts in this country, where they actually have In that sense, they're very interested in looking at the German model of co-determination, because they're really looking at seeing in this changing economic environment how might unions in this new framework play more of a role in making economic and policy decisions for private capital, and that's a new terrain for them. Previously you had this almost total domination of state enterprises, where the government controlled everything. And now with this huge growth of the private sector, it has led to a huge expansion and growth of the economy. It's also led to massive dislocation, which Elaine spoke to. Millions of laid off government workers. It's in this changed environment that unions are really trying to grapple with their new identity. And from our perspective, from the discussions we had with the ACFTU, really seeking different international models, what is going on around the world that we can learn from, how can we avoid some of the pitfalls and errors that have been made in other parts of the world. So I think that in our discussions with folks at the GM plant, that was just such a shock to us. Why is it that there isn't some level of conversation between the UAW and the GM Shanghai workers? Whose interest is being served by not having some level of discussion, dialogue? What are their pay rates? What is the profitability margin? How does this compare with, GM in the U.S.? Is that in our interest to have that information and to have an exchange and dialogue with, the union in Shanghai or not?
As you talk, both of you, the three of you, about the nature of unions and their organization, you haven't talked about the relation between the government and the unions. That is, what is the role of the political party? In America, unions are political activists as well as trade union activists. Now, in China, can a union engage in political action if the union leader or someone who wants to be a union leader once opposed the CP? Can he become a leader? I mean, what is the role of the CP and its tentacles concerning unionism and union leaders?
I'll start and maybe Elaine could add on. The Communist Party is changing very rapidly in China. There was a recent party congress. There was a brand new leadership that's been elected. They are now allowing capitalists into the Communist Party. They are allowing entrepreneurs and people from the private sector into the party. It's a whole new ballgame. And, it's still absolutely a work in progress. The ACFTU, for a number of years, has been very aggressive in trying to advocate for change in labor law in China. And they actually won some very significant legislation that was, passed in the last couple of years with much stronger provisions for protection of worker rights than before. This was something that was done through the political process of China. It's not the same type of political process in this country, but it is, the chair of the ACFTU who we met with in September was one of the seven standing members of the political bureau of the party. So he was one of the most influential and top leaders of the country. There was a whole leadership change, and so he is no longer in that position anymore. So, and ACFTU no longer has a representative among the top seven leaders of China. So I'm not sure if that means a diminishing of power or influence of the Chinese trade union movement or not. So these are like absolutely works in progress. And how we conceptualize, the role of unions in the political arena versus how they conceptualize it is quite different. I think in many ways, because of the close relationship between the ACFTU and the state, in many ways, they have more political power and can impact government clearly much more than the AFL-CIO has any control about what goes on in Washington, D.C. in terms of Congress or the White House. At the same time, because there is that close relationship, I think that there's real limits as to how much of a strong dissenting role they can play that is, you know, highly critical of governmental policy. So there's that, you know, interrelationship which has both advantages as well as profound disadvantages.
Let me just add, I'm a little more sanguine, you may have picked that up, than Kent is. I mean, look, the Communist Party is the sole party. There ain't no other party. And it is the government, but it's also, you know, the labor movement is seen as a transmission belt for the party into the working class, not a transmission. But a transmission belt, in theory, works both ways, and supposedly this is how the workers, you know, influence. And the number one policy of the party is, you know, it can be summarized in one word, and we heard it over and over and over and over again, stability. Because, you know, this is a country that when it goes through changes, you know, when, you know, the joke about, as a Canadian, we used to say, you know, when America sneezes, you know, Canada catches the cold, you know. But in China, there's a real fear of, you know, with all of these changes, major, massive turmoil. So what then happens is, I don't agree with Kent. I think that, look, when there are seven members of the secretariat key people in the government, and one is a trade unionist, and all of a sudden the head of the ACFTU is no longer one of that top seven. Duh. That's a weakening of power, and it reflects the fact that the ACTU is in trouble right now. I mean, you know, unlike the rest of the world labor movement. Everywhere in the world, labor is declining in its power. Its power is different. I mean, it does have much more influence, but one of the things it's fearing is that just like the rest of the world's labor movement, that our power is much stronger in the public sector than in the private sector. And there's a whole move towards more and more private sector. And they're not organizing well in the private sector, and they're not sure how to do it. Well, you know, like, stand in line with the rest of us. So again, these are areas where, you know, I think there can be really, really fruitful dialogue. Also, as a labor movement, they really are a mixed bag. I mean, I can tell you there are people who I felt were, you know, to be very explicit, who were being bought out, who, you know, with this changes, they were going to join the capitalists. And, you know, they saw the labor movement as a business, and they were going to do well in that business. But you know what? Not so long ago, I recall that I could name names about certain locals and certain unions that also felt that way in North America and other places. And then there were some really genuine folks who understood that this declining power, how to use what levers you got. And some of it is, you know, do we want to go in the direction, do the Chinese want to go in the direction of co-determination and German, where they can use what power they currently have to set up a structure where they will continue to have a voice in the senior leadership of enterprises and direct rights in those enterprises, or, you know, and those things were, you know, very much under discussion. And, you know, I would say it's the next 10 years will determine.
What is the private sector density?
It's about 20%. It's about 95 to 100%, or has been the state sector, and about 20% in the private sector.
But it's also a phony 20%, I would say, because one of the things is that enterprises are required to pay a percent, I think it's 1.6 or just under 2% of their payroll to the union. And so the union can collect money. It doesn't necessarily, you know, we visited a unionized enterprise where they didn't have a union there. So, but the human resource manager was very nice, and she was very sympathetic, and she and the union were meeting to see if they could start a union there. Well, you know, I mean, been there, done that, you do get, it is, I mean, the secret is you're getting one story from, you know, from one side. You're getting the story from the ICFTU and the AFL-CIO, which is that here's an organization of 20 million union folks in lockstep who think as one mind, the communist Chinese. And then, you know, that's one version. And then the other, which we're not arguing, is, you know, here's this vibrant movement that's just a little slow in picking up. That's a totally mixed bag. And in crisis, like the rest of the labor movement, going through major change.
I just want to add to that two quick stories. One is we met with the head of the Trade Union Federation in Dalian, which is this thriving community. It was a fishing village 18 years ago and is now has a population of 5.5 million residents. Talk about an economic boom. We met with the head of the Federation, but he also happened to be the secretary-treasurer of the Business Development Corporation in the city. And one other quick story. My previous trip, I met with the manager of a pharmaceutical plant, and, you know, the tradition, he sits there, and he kind of brief you, then take you around, give you a tour, then bring you back, and he asks questions. So we said, okay, this was very informative. Can we now meet with, you know, the head of the Communist Party in the plant. He said, well, actually, I'm the head of the Communist Party. I said, okay, that's very interesting. Can we meet with the head of the trade union in movement? And he said, well, that's me too. That's one extreme. But there are, I mean, on the other hand, you meet some really, really dyed-in-the-wool trade unionists who are... He also wants us to invest in this plan. I just want to underscore what Elaine just said. You meet the whole spectrum of people. Some of the people we met with were very, very sophisticated, politically very progressive, you know, people who you would clearly call comrades, and then you meet others. But again, it's the nature of the labor movement all over. I'm sorry, Andrew.
Yeah, my question is about Taiwan and Taiwanese integration, de facto integration. It seems to me that Taiwan is a very crucial hinge on both sides, the Cold War legacy side, which is still very much alive with respect to Taiwan. And on the other hand, the prospects for international labor solidarity, because the trade union movement there, of course, is faced with a sort of disastrous flight of capital and flight of jobs now that the Taiwanese government has lifted restrictions on direct investment in China. And it seems to me that, first of all, I wanted to know whether that entered into any of the debates you had, and whether you think there's any possibility of an international labor movement within Greater China, as it's often called. Because the business people in Greater China, the ethnic Chinese business people in Taiwan and Hong Kong and Malaysia and Indonesia and in the U.S., have this sort of international fraternity thing going. Whether there's been any attempt to think about doing that from the point of view of labor and having a Greater China type fraternity that would be international.
I actually traveled to Taiwan this past summer on a delegation sponsored by the Solidarity Center, the AFL-CIO, and I went there to support a campaign involving Chinese-American newspaper workers. The Chinese Daily News in Monterey Park have been involved in a fierce battle to organize the paper, and the corporate headquarters are in Taiwan. So I went with the lead worker on the campaign and someone from the FLCIO International Affairs Department to Taiwan, specifically to develop relationships with unions in Taiwan to support the workers' struggle here in this country. So it was a very exciting trip, and we were able to meet with both the Chinese Labor Federation that represents the old guard, Kuomintang, you know, very much company union types, as well as the Taiwan Confederation of Trade Unions, the TCTU, that represents a much more dynamic, younger, militant force. Yet both are relatively small and, you know, don't have a whole lot of power or influence. In Taiwan, there has been, a new change in government, and for the first time, the KMT is out of power. They are now the, you know, oppositional power party, and you have a leadership in Taiwan now that is both less rigid and less conservative than the KMT, and also more oppositional to the government on the mainland. So it's kind of an interesting tension that exists there. In spite of that, what I saw in both Taiwan and in my trips to the mainland were surprising levels of economic integration, surprising levels of exchange, of travel. There are parts of Shanghai and parts of that area and that region where you have literally thousands and thousands of Taiwanese who are now living there, they're going there to retire. They can now buy homes and property back on the mainland. So there is more economic, cultural, social integration between Taiwan and China than I ever would have imagined. And to be honest, it's really the U.S. government that is the major obstacle in the reunification of China. Yes, clearly there are political parties, including the ruling party today in Taiwan, that is kind of advancing an independence position in Taiwan. But if you would look at the major obstacle to diminishing conflict, diminishing tension, and strengthening the process of integration, it would be the U.S. government.
Two things. First, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that a lot of what you call the private sector in China are really companies owned by the army, and that they make a distinction in China between state-owned companies and army-owned companies. Secondly, it's always been my impression, correct me if I'm wrong, that the unions in China do not have the right to strike, and that they're really, in effect, company unions run by de facto either the guys who run the businesses or the guys who run the government. Do they have the right to strike? I mean, what's the story there? Are they real unions, or are they just unions in name?
I think it depends very much on the region. So the union leader, I go back to the whole issue of diversity. It's such a different place. We found, we talked about strikes. Matter of fact, when we were there were strikes in the northern provinces, and we raised that issue a number of times. These were unauthorized strikes. And the response from the union leaders varied greatly. Sometimes, people would emphasize, strikes are manipulated for political reasons. These are people who are really trying to overthrow the government, and so therefore we have to oppose them, and people should be thrown in jail because this is kind of revolutionary. Other people would say, look, this is where workers get their power, and strikes are legal, and China has signed the UN Covenant protecting the right to strike. But strikers are also thrown in jail. Both things exist simultaneously. We were told a story that when we asked about the strikes in the north, one of the trade union leaders we met with said, this was discussed with Chairman Wei, and his response was, look, we stand by the workers. At the same time, it's our role and responsibility to see that the strike ends, and we have to play a mediating role in this and make sure that the demands are reasonable. It's that ambiguity that so much defines the Chinese labor movement, I think, at this moment in time. They talk about their role is to represent the interests of the workers and the interest of the nation as a whole. Well, the interest of the nation as a whole, as they see it, is economic development. And they kept going back, look, we're talking about massive poverty. We're talking about, we're all, as Elaine put it, we're all equally poor. And now we're not. When I went to China my first time, they didn't have refrigerators, they didn't have, photocopy machines, they didn't have telephones, they didn't have basic things that were practically non-existent. We want to go there now, and there's a whole technological revolution, and people feel like, look, life is better. And so how do you balance your political principles and, you know, the need for foreign investment, for economic development? And that's the space that they're in and trying to grapple with. Well, you know, yes, of course, this is what we're about. We're about representing workers. On the other hand, you know, we've got to attract foreign investment. And so you see that, again, it's a similar thing that we go through, is, you know, how do you undercut yourself to attract that foreign investment in your town or your community? And it puts the union in a very difficult and, you know, compromising position. The other hand, they're sitting there fighting for, you know, workers' rights in legislation and workers' rights on the shop floor, but they're trying to walk a very fine line.
Two points. First of all, Kent, as aggressive a policy the AFL-CIO has in China, it has it on Cuba. So its Latin American policy has not changed, in my opinion, sufficiently. Second point, China is having an enormous impact on the American economy already. What does that say, about how relations between workers and unions in the United States and China can be brought forward? In other words, Chinese industrial development is having an enormous impact in American manufacturing right now. It seems to be much greater than we think. One reason I think our recession is as deep as it is we're seeing a more impact of not just third world, but specifically China industrial development inputs. Well, how do American workers and unions relate to this?
That's
good.
Got everyone?
Sure. Poorly. No, I think one of the problems is that the vision has been just say no. I mean, that's our policy, right? I mean, just, you know, no trucker trade with China. It's obviously worked very well because we now have the largest trade deficit with China ever in history, and all projections are that it will keep going. So, you know, maybe we should just do what's failed harder and stronger and keep doing it because, you know, failure sort of leads to newer and higher and better failures. My view is that that's probably not the best way to go about it, that that China will continue to grow, that and that what we need to do is actually, it's in our American and worldwide interest to have a powerful labor movement in China and to resist some of the changes that are going on in China, including to bring up some of the actual practiced labor standards, not the ones on the books, but the ones being able to enforce, to build some sort of relationship amongst workers so that we can have a little more fair trade. And you don't do that by standing in America and saying, we speak for the benefit of the Chinese workers who we won't talk to because we think they got a company union and we're not in favor of that. And so instead, we'll speak for the Chinese workers and we say don't go because that ain't going to work. So instead, what we need to do is we need to go over there. We need to be, and quite frankly, even if it means talking with, even if you don't like the ACFTU, even if you don't see it as much more complex the way we've argued, even if you see it that way, you need to talk to it to get in. I mean, I see American corporations who wouldn't piss on workers if they were on fire going over there to China, thinking nothing of it, quite happy. And I'm afraid, no, it's not just the Chinese, it's not the Chinese military that owns all of these independent enterprises, because if you think American capitalism pours money into China to give it to the Chinese military so they can profit, you don't understand American capitalism. That what they are is joint ventures with the Chinese frankly, we visited a joint venture with Pfizer, and I remember saying, oh, joint venture. I mean, I'm naive. I said, so what percent do the Chinese own? They said, oh, 3%. I said, 3%? That's not a joint venture. Let me understand this. You put up the building. You do all the infrastructure. You provided and trained the workforce, and you got a lousy 3%? Let me tell you, we can help you with bargaining. You know, we can do better than that. that. And, you know, and they said, oh, that's great. You know, we got 3%, right? And that's a joint enterprise. No, it isn't. That's a snow job. So, I mean, there's some basis upon which there's real needs there. And I think there's things we can learn from them. I think Kent was hinting at, look, they work the system a bit. Sometimes they work it and it's corrupt. Well, other times, frankly, they work it and they can use the power of, you know, all of their relationships in a particular area to sort of bring a company up and say, no, we're not going to do that. And so, you know, I think my experience in Solidarity is that it's actually a mutual learning. China is the workshop of the world. And you know what? The workshop of the world has moved to different places at different times. And burying your head in the sand doesn't change that. And in fact, being proactive, sort of saying, okay, what are the forces there? What companies? What sort of relations? My own view, by the way, is that the least effective way of dealing with this is the highest levels of the AFL-CIO and the highest levels of the ACFTU. You know, I mean, they'll eat well, drink well, and they'll have interesting discussions that signify nothing. The far more valuable level will be when people in, you know, in the pharmaceutical area are meeting with unions in the pharmaceutical areas in China, and that you start to build real worker-to-worker and industry-wide relationships, because there you're dealing with, you know, the real concrete situation. That's where you start to provide information back and forth that people don't know about. Things like for the American workers to know just how much is going to China, what the wage rates, what the profitability rates are, and what pieces. And it allows us to develop an international strategy to compete with the global capital international strategy. But
running out of time, we're going to take three...
May back there.
Yeah. Okay. And it's been fairly male-dominated so far, so May, and here, and then...
I resent that.
I forgot it
already.
Okay.
Another year.
First of all, I really want to thank the three.
And chairmanship.
Yeah, and also Queen's College for having this. This has been one of the, actually, most exciting workshops that I've been to, because I guess working in Unite, which has been battered by so-called imports, China, and the whole bit, and our members who are mostly Chinese immigrants, you know, really understand very deeply this double-edged sword. Many of them came from China, and then they're working in the United States, but they're seeing all the companies and the jobs and stuff flow back to China. So I'm really glad to hear a much more textured and in-depth discussion of this issue, because I've hosted a lot of groups from China who were brought by the State Department, by unions locally, and everything else. I really wanted especially to say thanks to Elaine, because I think the complexity of the issue, and yet the real need to engage with these unions is just absolutely, I agree with it. I hope that this, you know, deepens that. And I'm glad to have a debrief from all three of you as to your trip. I wanted to ask you to talk about, other than the ACFTU, other types of union organizing or worker organizing, if you observe any in your trips. I have met recently with some people who are, I mean, I've met in the past with people at Han Dongfang and, you know, the dissident so-called independent union leaders, but who are mostly in exile, so very hard for them to really do a lot because they're essentially not really allowed back into China. I've met with them in Hong Kong and here. But recently I did meet with a guy from Shanghai who is doing labor advocacy as an attorney. And he came and he really wanted to see strikes in the United States. We took him to some of our little, you know, job actions and stuff like that. And he talked about the importance of in the private sector, which I'm glad you really pointed out is a lot owned by foreign companies, that they feel that there is a need for advocacy from the Chinese-based organizations, whether they're ACFTU or not. And he was very critical of the ACFTU, that there have to be other ways that they organize in China to fight for the rights of the workers in those private enterprises. So I'd like to ask you to comment on that.
Yeah. One of the things we've started to look at, you may know there's a Berkman Center for Law and Society, or sorry, for the Internet and Society at Harvard. You can find their website at Harvard Law School, Berkman Center, B-E-R-K-M-A-N, now has a China monitoring thing. So what you can do is you can test a website like, you know, China Watch, and you can see whether that's being screened, filtered in China so that you can't get it in. And so you can literally put in the name of any website or any Internet traffic and see to what extent it's being filtered. You can also do the same thing for Saudi Arabia, as a matter of fact. And the Berkman's been monitoring this now for a few years. And we've been looking at that data and sort of trying to figure out, so if it's, you know, if it's human rights writ large, you know, it's... But what's sort of interesting is here you got Labor Start, which is, you know, labor news. And what's really interesting is the same sort of human rights issue that deals with workers that was filtered on, you know, Human Rights Watch's website actually comes into China anyway through Labor Start. So, And when I was in China, we at different times sort of tried to sign on to different websites, and I found it interesting to see which ones were filtered and which ones weren't. And so one of the things we're now discovering is there's a number of groups who are interested in setting up websites. And if you avoid certain terms that just, you know, get run up a flag, then you can get away with a remarkable amount of things. For instance, there's a website now in China, in Chinese, that talks about what workers' rights are and basically lays out the law and puts them in touch with other people and those types of things. We're looking at thinking about how to... one of the things we've looked at is that China use of computers, email, and the Internet, certainly in the cities, is growing exponentially. And what's sort of also interesting is that it's not just taking place in the workplace. Most North Americans access the computer primarily in work, during working hours, too, by the way. But in China, it's a tremendous amount that's actually happening in people's homes, which I certainly was startled by. And so those are some of the things. The other thing we're discovering is that the higher up you go, the more difficult it is to deal with these types of issues because you're dealing at the level that's much more political, much more, and I mean big P political. But as you move down so that you look at the state level, you know, the various provinces and states, and you look at a city level, then all of a sudden a resource type basis, a relationship is much more possible. We're dealing with some of the law schools in China sort of interested in sort of is there some form of private mediation and arbitration rather than, and what would that look like? Because, you know, Chinese are many things, but they're not idiots. And they're very, you know, if you're thinking from a national point of view in China about how you're going to grow the economy, and remember the number one principle is stability, then it's very costly to suppress workers' protests. Those workers' protests represent real problems. So the state wants to try and deal with that, like any other state. And so thinking about what sort of agencies for doing that, which then creates, by the way, a little bit of a crisis in the ACFTU, because every time, you know, it's like for a union. For a union, a wildcat is a mixed bag of things. On the one hand, you know, you can't be sued because it's not our fault and the workers did it on their own. On the other, if the employer thinks that the union doesn't really speak for the workers, then the employer can ignore the union. So you need to, you know, it's always a very tricky issue. So I think my own view is that I think looking at the website, looking at the way I look at the ACFTU is that you get the nod from the top as you enter, and then you don't pay like a whole lot of attention to engaging at the top. Because, you know, quite frankly, when we make relationships with the German labor movement, we don't spend a whole lot of time in the headquarters of the labor center. We actually go down to, you know, the enterprise-based works councils or the particular union that works in the sector we're interested in. And I don't think we should treat China any differently. And I do think that inside the World Labor Movement that actually engages with China, there are tremendous differences about to what extent you even talk with the ACFTU versus do you engage it. My own view is that you engage it, but you also engage other folks. And one last point is people may not realize, but there are a tremendous amount of Chinese citizens abroad. Quite frankly, if the American universities booted out Chinese citizens studying in the United States universities, our science departments would mostly collapse. I kid you not. And that people forget that the Chinese students abroad and workers abroad have access to internet, are learning all sorts of things abroad, will go back to China, and that they are a network not of thousands, but actually hundreds of thousands of very bright, articulate folks who also have influence in China, not just the Asian Americans, but also really Chinese citizens abroad, which increasingly are using the web and internet, and that again pushes back home. We've got to be thinking about how we're using it, and because it's a marvelous tool for engaging people in discussions and sharing information.
One point that was made earlier was that the loss of a position on the political bureau by the ACFTU representative was a loss of power. I could see why that you would could understand it that way, but I would also think that it might be a reflection of a demonstration of the independence or the potential for the independence of the union and for a greater opening up of the discussion within the union and a greater independent movement, which would give us a greater opportunity on the part of the American labor movement to engage them. Do you see it that way, as a hopeful step rather than a loss of power?
I would have to say it's sort of like saying, well, when Clinton was the president, labor leaders could go to the White House, and now that, we got Bush, isn't it good for the labor movement because now we're not sucked in by the Democrats in the administration? You could sort of say that, but you'd also sort of say, but wait, I'm not sure that, that's the best way to sort of break labor leaders from the White House habit. I think it's a very costly way of doing it. I think the fact that the ACFTU is now not on the Central Committee reflects more a relationship of forces, and that it's being one that, and I don't see yet, my own vision, I don't see yet that the ACFTU is sort of yet ready to or sees itself as, throwing itself out there as an outsider, as a rebel with the cause. I don't see that.
I mean the top.
I don't mean
the top. I meant the rank and file, or the smaller unions.
Yeah, I can't. I really can't speak on that. I really don't know. I just tend to. I know after Tiananmen, I think before Tiananmen, the ACFTU was moving in a much more sort of independent way, and after Tiananmen sort of pulled right in was, stability became the key principle, and I think it remains a very important principle. My own view is as the labor movement weakens in power, it goes through all sorts of debates, and eventually I like to think that continued workers' protest, it as a movement will have to decide which side are you on. And I think as its power weakens, it's going to look for other vehicles of power, and often those vehicles, most labor movements stumble upon the startling notion of mobilized workers are a source of power.
Based on what you were saying, it seems that what you're suggesting, that most of these labor organizations, ACFTU, whatever independent ones exist,
have endorsed a capitalist path to economic development. Based on your travels and on your communication with different segments of the labor movement, are there any that have questioned this, who are looking for an alternative to the capitalist path? And the reason why I'm, and I also want to know whether or not, and this is Greg, you made a comment earlier where you were extolling the virtues of the economic development taken by the Chinese government, the fact that they have more refrigerators and more stoves and appliances and other consumer goods. Are you suggesting that this is the only way in which economic development can occur?
No, not at all. And I think that if you look at my article, I urge you to read it. It's I'm obviously very displeased with the inequities that have developed in China. But when you're talking to somebody and you're saying to them, "But look at why couldn't you do this with the socialist path?" Then they come back to you and they say, "Yes, but we tried that, and we had an iron rice bowl, and we all shared that one lousy rice bowl." When I said in the beginning of my remarks that this was sobering, that's what I meant. I'm not advocating that this is the proper path, but I am trying to understand the problems that they are facing, the decisions that they have to make, and I think that the ones that are more politically sophisticated are grappling with the same issues. How do you raise a nation up from abject poverty? And right now, those people who are clinging to socialist principles are in a very weak position because they turn to other workers and workers say yes, but all those years we didn't have any of these basic necessities, and now many of us do. And yes, we're leaving people behind, but as our leadership tells us, some people have to get rich first. And we don't buy that, but nonetheless, I'm trying to, and I think we're all trying to illustrate the difficulty that the Chinese progressives are having at the moment.
Progressives in the sense that what they want is capitalism with a human face, as you do. Is that how you define it?
No. I think that, look, some people, we asked a question about why did China privatize the private enterprise, the state enterprises. And we were told there were three reasons. Some people will argue that it was because in the state enterprise, nobody was accountable. It was just not very clear who was in charge and who was ultimately responsible for productivity, for wages, for all that. Other people would argue that the problem was they were just not efficient. Productivity was dismal. And the third group, the socialists, would argue that it was because there was no real workers' control, that despite all the trappings of the former China, in the end, the workers' congresses were bogus, that the workers' control of the enterprise wasn't real, and that, in fact, what had developed was a bureaucracy that controlled. Well, those are three very different strands. The people who believe that, China didn't have enough workers' control are in a very distinct minority right now. I suspect that the truth lies somewhere in between all of those. And I don't know the answer. I don't know what China could have done differently. But I think, what has happened is that they're experiencing a tremendous economic boom, but they're also leaving a lot of people behind, and that eventually that boom will burst, that bubble will burst, and the Chinese workers will be in a very difficult way. On the other hand, and I think this is the main point that we all agree with here, is that if it's not the ACFTU, then who, in terms of trying to mediate that situation?